From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, a former Wall Street Journal correspondent works to improve nutrition and reduce hunger around the world. Later, writer Seth Davis sets out to learn more about iconic college basketball coach John Wooden.
You know, guys of our age and generation, you know, we think of John Wooden as a sweet old guy reading poetry in his den. But, you know, you don't win 10 national championships by being sweet. So I felt like there was a third dimension to this man.
And fantasy writer Jalee Johnson explains why middle grade readers are an ideal audience.
I like their sense of wonder. I have heard my writing described as kind of quirky, maybe a little bit romantic, maybe kind of odd, and kids, for whatever reason, seem to respond to that. They like the quirky characters, the detailed fantasy worlds. They like to get lost in them.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. It's great to have you listening today. Around 5 years ago, Roger Thoreau was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He was working on a book with a colleague about global hunger, and he hit upon a mantra that would spark a shift in his career. As the book came out and his Outrage and Inspire effort was born, Thoreau left his position in Africa and at the newspaper where he'd worked for 3 decades and signed on at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs as Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy. It's in that role that he continues to work on hunger issues around the world, including here in the U.S. His work more recently has grown to include another project on the importance of early nutrition called the Thousand Days Project. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about that work and stop by the Lake Effect studio along with Magda Peck, the dean of the UWM School of Public Health. Roger Thoreau, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So you have this Outrage and Inspire project underway, and there are a lot of people out there who have dedicated time and resources to doing something about hunger around the world, but I gather one area in which you feel like you can especially contribute is in your ability to tell stories.
Yes, and thank you. I think that's a critical aspect of this, that as we look kind of back at books that had been written on this issue, a lot of them were kind of academic books, so they were like development textbooks, you know, for classroom studies. Or they were written by economists, and they're looking at things from 40,000 feet down. Or they were like polemics or screeds by somebody who's got an angle that they're really driving.
Trying to shame us into change.
Yeah, precisely. Or, you know, promoting some other aspect of that, you know, this is really great or something. And we just figured that just the storytelling of particularly the people on the ground in the developing world, and in my case especially in Africa, and when we're seeing all this come into play and the impact, say, of American policies, unintended in you know, consequences of, say, our farm bill or the way we did our food aid, the global trade of agriculture, really saw that come into play during the Ethiopian famine of 2003. And I wrote a lot about that for the Wall Street Journal. And that, I think that impact and being able to tell those stories of here's these consequences and here's the people that are suffering by having brought hunger into the 21st century, and shame on us for doing that.
Well, and so where does the Thousand Days Project fit into this dynamic?
Yeah, so it's kind of the progression of the reporting that I was doing. And say after the Ethiopian famine of 2003, we're kind of in the midst of that. You know, I'd been, as I said, a foreign correspondent for the journal for close to 2 decades by that time, and doing and behaving as foreign correspondents do. You travel from country to country and place to place and story to story, and then, boom, you move on and you go to some other place. That story, the famine of Ethiopia in 2003, it was the first great famine, the first great hunger crisis of the 21st century, really stopped me cold. It was what was then inspiring my journalism, that this is one story that I cannot leave. I have to keep coming back to this story. So that was kind of, you know, one talks about kind of, you know, positive disruption or things, you know, both in, you know, technology or whatever. This in my life as a journalist, or my career as a journalist in my life, really changed things, that this is the one story I want to write about. So I wrote that first book with Scott on Enough, Why the World's Poor Suffer in an Age of Plenty. And then the second book I did, wanting to follow on that, was to really look at the smallholder farmers, again, particularly in Africa, who were kind of bearing the brunt of of this neglect.
Explain the significance of smallholder farmers. I don't know that that's a term that everybody knows what it means.
Right. So smallholder farmers, different than, say, the concept here. Smallholder farmers, say, in an African context would be like maybe 3 acres that they would have, maybe kind of at the most, half acre, 1 acre, 2 acres. And it's on that small plot of land that they have to feed their families. And then hopefully have a surplus or something that they're able to sell for, you know, to improve their house, to diversify their farm, to pay for the kids' school education, to pay for the malaria medication, health issues. It's these smallholder farmers then kind of because this neglect of agriculture development, you know, that kind of all the big development agencies in the world were kind of part of, including USAID and the British DFID. These farmers were kind of ignored, and people kind of said, you know, they're too poor, too remote, too small, too insignificant. Who kind of cares about them? They're not possible clients or customers, or what kind of market are they? So the result of all that is that they were far behind farmers everywhere else in the world in terms of yields. Say in comparison to American farmers, maybe their yields of corn or maize would be maybe 1/10 of what the farmers here would get on, say, per acre. Wheat, beans, you know, anything, the vegetables that they're growing, all really lagging behind. And the upshot of that was, which I think is perhaps the cruelest irony of Africa, is that Africa's hungriest people are her smallholder farmers. And it creates this bizarre and stupid and obscene oxymoron of hungry farmers.
And presumably this plays into the Thousand Days project because these hungry farmers are raising hungry children.
Exactly. And so it was kind of the progression then of the coverage of the Wall Street Journal in the first two books I did that then led me into the Thousand Days. And particularly looking at the importance of nutrition in those Thousand Days, so during a woman's pregnancy and the vital the necessity of the minerals and nutrients that the mom needs, and then in the first 2 years of a child's life, when the brain is growing, you know, most rapidly, and it's when stunting begins, the physical and mental stunting of a child begins at that stage. But a couple of the farm families that I was following then in the last hunger season, there were 4 farm families in western Kenya. A couple of the children in those families were manifestly malnourished. And there I saw that in this time of the hunger season, which is the period between when the food from the previous harvest runs out, is either consumed by the family or sold for whatever purposes for the income, and when the next harvest comes in. And that can be a period of, say, a couple of weeks, or in one of the farm families in the story, it stretched on for 9 or 10 months. So it's this period of profound deprivation. When the number of where food is rationed, the number of meals decline from 3 a day to 2 to 1, to some days basically nothing except maybe a weak cup of porridge in the morning or a cup of tea, you know, without sugar, and just kind of water with a little bit of tea flavor in it. And there, kind of in the midst of that, to see the deepest form of that misery, to be a mother who is raising a malnourished child, or to be a mother who cannot stop the crying of a malnourished and hungry child. And that then was then the beginning, while I was still reporting that book and finishing the writing of that, then thinking of what's next. And the Thousand Days movement was starting to form, the whole scaling up nutrition, international development starting to focus on this period and the impact for economies of countries, for the health of the world, for the individual health, that I figured, yeah, this would be something that I'd really concentrate on. And so for the Thousand Days, I'm following women starting at some stage in their pregnancy and then following through the second birthday of the child in Uganda, India, Guatemala, and then in the U.S., and I'm following some families in Chicago.
And that really struck me that we think of nutrition, sadly, in the developing world as being a significant issue, but it is an issue in this country as well.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to include the United States, that it's just not a problem that's over there somewhere in those countries, but it's also a vital issue here. And then in Chicago, I was living in Chicago at the time when started this project, and so that was convenient. But also the issue that Chicago was dealing with in the research going on in terms of food deserts. The mayor at the time was, you know, closing schools in Chicago. You know, maybe one of the reasons for failed schools is because the children in that crucial time of development, maybe they're not getting the proper nutrition, so they're not even prepared to go to school in kindergarten and first grade when they start. And so, kind of setting up this path of failure.
As you look at this problem, and look towards solutions, how much of what is needed do you think is technology? How much is money? And how much is willpower?
Willpower is a critical thing that people recognize this problem and say we've got to do something about it. And I think particularly as they would look at their comparative statistics of where Chicago or Milwaukee sits or Wisconsin or Illinois kind of sit on a national scale on these things, you would think that kind of the political leaders would say, my goodness, look where we're standing here. We can't have that. We have to be improved, particularly in this area where we're in the Midwest with the most fertile soils in the world. We're the breadbasket of the world. And we have these problems here, you know, kind of what's going on. But the other thing is, in terms of investments, I think it really shows that investments in women and investments in children are really important and need to be prioritized. And then also starting at this early stage, whether it's kind of early childhood education, nutrition information and education, the prenatal care. And the education information, it's just very simple and basic about the nutrients that are important, the importance of a diversified diet. And the interesting thing in my reporting is that is something that I'm hearing, whether it is being a midwife in Africa talking to a group of pregnant moms or moms with newborn infants who are sitting under a tree in Africa, or it's the instruction that's going on a veranda in a house in India, or in a little community center somewhere in Guatemala, or in a living room or a kitchen here in the United States. It's the same message and the same kind of basic education that goes on. The nutrition and also the sanitation, so the proper, you know, hand washing and sanitary environment where the moms are living and the kids are growing up, because that's really important for kind of the parasite load and just the cleanliness of things.
I want to bring Magda Peck in this conversation as well for this final question, and that is, who has to drive this change? And if you're listening to this in Milwaukee, you know, what's the role that someone in the community here plays in this whole equation?
Well, the first is to recognize there's no one thing we can do, so we can't just easily fix it. And one of the things I find about being in Milwaukee and in other cities is that we like the simple solution, and this does not have a simple solution, but it's not unsolvable. I think part of what's happening in Milwaukee is we tend to think about, well, we'll feed people. We'll give an extra box of Cheerios. We'll fill it up with surplus cans that I wasn't used for the last 6 months. That's not going to fix the problem. I think the big deal about doing something about it is to reframe it and recognize that it has a sense of urgency. So I love the 1,000 days approach because it says that we get to talk about what we're doing in infant mortality, what we're doing in early childhood education, and what we're doing about food deserts and food security. All together, right now those conversations are happening in lots of different places. So first I would say recognize that it is happening here. It's happening here with urgency, perhaps a quieter one. Recognize there isn't a single thing to do, and yes, bring that can to church, but know that that's not going to fix it, that it really is about understanding how food systems work and how we can work across our different initiatives in town so that when we're talking about infant mortality, we're talking about healthy nutrition, we're talking about early childhood education and school success, we're not just going to different meetings and not connecting the dots.
I think one of the key things there is the empowerment of women and moms, that they have a lot to say about this themselves. Empowerment of communities and neighborhoods around this, that, you know, we don't have – and when one sees this in some places like in India, you know, communities that I'm looking at are kind of gathering around the whole aspect of reducing infant mortality. Why are so many of our children dying under five or within the first month of life or something? You know, what can we do about that as mothers? I think then kind of as a greater community as a whole for the political will, you said, and the politicians. But I think it's also so critical that, say, the business community gets involved in this because the impact falls directly on them eventually. This all catches up when you have the, say, undernourished or a slow development or undernourishment of a child and then the cognitive development that may lag because of that. That all comes through the school system and it ends up certainly in the workforce. And as the workforce becomes increasingly skilled and the tasks and jobs that are required, increasing education needed, increasing skills, this workforce is an educated and a skilled and a really cognitive developed workforce is really important.
there are so many assets to build on in Milwaukee. This is not a starting place, but this is a growing place. A real shout-out needs to go not only to Growing Power and the Hunger Task Force and Fondy Food Market and Walnut Way and the Food Council. There is a movement happening in this city that is recognizing that it's not enough just to hand people a meal, but it goes back to growing food, supplying food. Healthy choice becomes the easy choice. And that's conversations that are happening in folks' kitchens, in local gardening plots, in Alice's garden. And it's something that is bubbling up. So this notion of local empowerment is there. What's needed is to have a shared vision and the fact that we need to be doing more now and it can be done. So inspire, yes, but a little outrage could go a long way. We have our own hunger season. Our hunger period here is the period when the food stamps run out and the next check doesn't come yet.
Yeah,
it's when the refrigerator is going on empty. We have our own hunger season from when kids go home from a food program where they're able to get reduced school lunches and be fed breakfast. And they're stuffing their pockets to be able to then have enough food in their backpacks on the weekend, or we send them home with fruit. That's the quiet hunger season, is the weekends or the summer when school's out. We should say, that is not on our watch.
Magda Peck, Roger Thoreau, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Roger Thoreau is Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, creator of the Outrage and Inspire Project, and author of two books, including Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. He grew up just down the road in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Magda Peck is the Dean of the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. They talked to us last month. The story of the first iconic college basketball coach when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Marquette University made waves in the sports world twice this year, once when basketball coach Buzz Williams abruptly announced he was leaving to take the coaching job at Virginia Tech, and then weeks later when the Milwaukee school announced it had hired Steve Wojciechowski away from his assistant coaching position at Duke to replace Williams. In an era in which star basketball players often transfer or leave for the NBA in less than 4 years, coaches are typically the face of a college basketball program. And the first of these people was John Wooden, who coached UCLA to 10 NCAA championships and to an unequaled 88-game winning streak. But there are parts to the Wooden story that have largely gone untold since he left coaching in 1975. Writer Seth Davis tries to fill in some of the answers in his recent biography, Wooden, A Coach's Life. Davis was this year's Axthelm Lecturer at Marquette University, and he stopped by the studio in April. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Great to be in Milwaukee.
What do you find most compelling about college basketball coaches as a whole?
They're crazy. They're all different kinds of crazy, but they're crazy. Make no mistake about it. But crazy makes for good copy. And I really enjoy my interactions. I really enjoy my conversations. I mean, I really believe that the vast, vast, vast majority of these guys are in it for the right reasons. You know, you don't get into college coaching for the money. Not at the beginning. You're certainly well aware that at the end of the rainbow, if you're one of the very, very fortunate few, very few to reach a high level, that you can make a lot of money. But most of these guys are grinders. Most of these guys did not, unlike NBA coaches, did not play the game at a very high level. You got a lot of really great former players coaching in the NBA. In college, it's all guys who weren't good enough to go to the NBA. Yet they were competitive freaks.
Is that what makes the transition difficult for some college coaches who try to go on to the NBA?
No, I think what makes the transition difficult there is getting into a bad situation. You know, the NBA is all about franchise, your organization, your general manager, your team president. Most NBA coaches get fired after a couple of years anyway. So, with Brad Stevens' success in Boston, I think the NBA is going to be looking more to the college ranks in the future. But, I think a lot of these coaches in college, Mitch, at some point in their lives, they had a coach who had a very profound impact on them. And I think they want to turn around and have that same kind of impact on other young players. I like being around these guys.
Is there something even more significant about the place of coaches today as players spend less time in school before the good ones jump to the NBA?
Well, you're talking about a very few number of players, you know, compared to, you know, when you think about there are 340 teams in Division I, and, you know, there's 10 to 13 scholarship players on each team. Every year, there's, you know, maybe one or two dozen players who are good enough to go to the NBA. The bigger phenomenon that's going on right now, Mitch, is transferring. I mean, you're having, I want to say it's, fewer than half of the players coming into Division I will finish their careers at the same schools. Now, there's some pluses to that. There's some minuses to that. But I mean, I think basically the dynamic is the same. You have an older coach who considers himself a teacher, who wants to, you know, see his kids graduate and do well in life and have the relationship with them after they graduate and be that presence in their lives that they had at some point.
So even within that context, what made John Wooden such a compelling figure to you?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, he was mysterious, you know, for a guy who was written about a lot and multiple books published about him. Most of the books that came out about Wooden were either written by John Wooden, with John Wooden, or for John Wooden. But it had been a very long time since someone had written a book about John Wooden, what I would consider, what you would consider to be a classic biography by a journalist, by a historian. John Wooden had been presented as this two-dimensional character, you know, never had any flaws, never had a bad day, nobody was ever mad at him, nobody ever criticized him, and that's not real life. You know, guys of our age and generation, you know, we think of John Wooden as a sweet old guy reading poetry in his den. But, you know, you don't win 10 national championships by being sweet. So I felt like there was a third dimension to this man that had not been presented. Not that I wanted to write any kind of takedown, but I just wanted to write something that was a little more real and balanced and thorough and three-dimensional.
So even within this idea of even-handedness, I gather you would contend that John Wooden really was instrumental in expanding the footprint of college basketball beyond, say, its original hotspots in the East and in Indiana?
Yeah, no question, Mitch. And, you know, that really is, in terms of the game, his greatest legacy. You know, it's not like you look out there today and you see certain offenses or certain defenses that can be traced back to John Wooden, as would be the case, for example, someone like Bob Knight. You know, John Wooden would be the first to tell you that he was not a great X's and O's strategist. That was not his forte. You know, in a lot of ways, this was quite an accident for him. People forget or didn't know. It took John Wooden 16 years before he won his first NCAA championship. This championship run that he enjoyed came at the tail end of his career. In fact, it took him 14 years to win his first game in the NCAA tournament. You think Steve Wojciechowski was going to make 14 years before winning a game in the NCAA tournament? This was a high school English teacher from Martinsville, Indiana, who came out to UCLA through a lot of happenstance, had no intention of staying, thought he'd be there a couple of years and then come back to the Midwest, probably go back to Purdue where he played, and then, you know, grew up on a small farm in Indiana with no electricity running water, came of age in the Great Depression, would have been a terrific professional basketball player had there been such a thing as professional basketball.
And he turned down the chance to play some form of pro basketball,
right? Well, he actually did play to the extent what was professional basketball back then, which were these little professional teams. Now, you had some larger clubs in the East, specifically the Celtics and the Wrens, the Harlem Wrens, which are a very famous all-black team, you know, back in the 1930s, 1940s. But John Wooden was teaching English in South Bend, Indiana during the week, and then on the weekend he was playing professional basketball. I mean, it's hard to imagine LeBron James teaching English during the week. And then so it all kind of happened quite by accident. I mean, he was certainly a great coach, but eventually he got some great players and then he got some momentum. And it came at a time when television was becoming prominent. And, you know, he created, ironically, Mitch, those 12 years when he was winning championships were, in many respects, the 12 unhappiest years of his life. He was a very thin-skinned man. He had a lot of insecurities, which a lot of it, I think, I trace back to his coming of age in the Great Depression, and dealt with criticism and pressure and expectations that in a lot of ways sapped his joy from the experience. And, you know, that last championship that he won in 1975 was, I would argue, his least talented team. So he was very much on top of his game. He retired, as he said to his players, he was stepping away, not because he wanted to, but because he had to. He had created a monster and he was being devoured by it, and he had to bow out.
You mentioned his image, this image that most of us of a certain age have of him as this kind of grandfatherly, avuncular character. But I gather that doesn't necessarily square with the guy that he was with his players.
No. He was a very competitive guy. Well, the first thing that people learn about John Wooden in this book that they're very surprised about is he had a very controversial reputation with respect to referees. He was renowned for writing referees, partly because he didn't believe in talking much to his players during games. His philosophy was he's going to teach them how to play the game during practice, and then the game becomes their final exam. He would tell them, don't look over at the bench. He didn't call timeouts. So he had to have someone to talk to, and usually it was referees. And there was a lot of resentment from his fellow coaches who thought he was disingenuous with his public persona because he would sit there with his legs crossed and his program rolled up, and people thought he was, you know, Mr. Pepperidge Farm, as Lou Alcindor liked to call him, when really he was using that program as a megaphone to ride refs. He was very hard on his players, Mitch, but more than that, he was emotionally unavailable to his players. Again, he grew up, we're talking about a guy, you know, early on he had two sisters, but they both died, one shortly after childbirth and one at the age of three of diphtheria. So he had three brothers and a father. He grew up in a very male environment. You didn't hug, you didn't kiss, you didn't say I love you. You may have felt it, and in his own way, he was expressing it to his players that he loved his players, but he didn't connect with them emotionally. And, you know, a lot of them left their experience playing for him, particularly towards the end of his career when he was coaching a different type of player, different type of student athlete who had emotional needs that he was unable to meet. They left their experience playing for him feeling very ambivalent toward him and in many cases very resentful toward him, especially if they are among those who didn't play.
And I gather that the one scandal that's often associated with him, the booster scandal,
right,
resulted, you would contend, in part from the fact that he was emotionally unavailable to his players.
Absolutely. That's a great insight, Mitch, because they dealt with him when they came to practice and when they came to games. And these stories that he told later in life about, you know, how we used to have all these long talks with them. And I mean, he talked about how he had a certain time of day in his office that he had to be there because his players would come by just to talk and visit with him. That was pure fiction. He may have been in there, but there weren't any players in there. There were very few outside of, you know, the occasional Bill Walton or Bill Cunningham, Gary Cunningham's of the world. But no, there was a void that was filled by a man named Sam Gilbert, who could relate to his John Wooden's players, specifically his black players, on a level that Wooden had no interest in and no ability to relate to them. Again, we're talking about the late 1960s, early 1970s, Westwood, California, a lot of money flowing around. And Sam Gilbert took care of a lot of their financial needs, which was, of course, in direct violation of NCAA rules. And this was really the most controversial aspect of John Wooden's story. John Wooden did not orchestrate this. He did not like it. He warned his players against affiliating themselves with Sam Gilbert, took it to his athletic director, talked to his athletic director, who was a very sort of officious, strong personality, type A, very much the boss, guy named J.D. Morgan. He told Wooden, you coach the team, I'll take care of Sam Gilbert. The NCAA certainly had no intention of killing its golden goose at that time. And so there are a lot of things going on, and I think you could certainly make the case that this was sort of a gray area with Wooden. Like I say, he didn't orchestrate it, and certainly there were Sam Gilberts at every program or many programs around the country. Where I think John Wooden very fairly comes under criticism here, Mitch, is he spent the last 35 years of his life giving interviews and talking and lecturing about integrity and telling a very much revised story of Sam Gilbert and all that went on. And I think, as I've written, you know, there's a certain amount of resentment amongst coaches of John Wooden's era that here they called him St. John. And that was not a compliment, that he would come across as sanctimonious and holier than thou. And meanwhile, he's got this booster who's doing all these nefarious things in his program. So it's a complicated story because it's real life and real life is complicated.
Well, and how do you contrast the St. John that existed, if you will, with some other iconic coaches of that time, say the one that people would know the best here in Milwaukee, Al McGuire?
Well, the difference between Al McGuire and John Wooden is that Al McGuire had no desire or no ability to hide any of his foibles. Al McGuire's foibles were very much out in front. And he was a character. In fact, you know, I uncovered her, and I'm not sure this really made it into the book, but they're actually pretty good friends, McGuire and Wooden. And you wouldn't think so.
A much different style.
But you would, though, wouldn't you? I mean, it makes sense that Al McGuire and John Wooden would get a kick out of each other because they were so different, but very much open-minded men, very much thinker, philosopher types. Al McGuire, and I know this did not make it into the book. I think Wooden told the story about McGuire that Al McGuire was going to Australia, and he was bringing his motorcycle, and he was just going to ride his motorcycle all around Australia. And Wooden had been there for a clinic, and he gave him a couple of different places to go, and they had this long conversation. And McGuire came back, and he hadn't gone to any of those places. And Wooden said, "Why?" And he says, "I just went to the bars, Johnny. You don't know anything about the bars. I just went to bars." So they got a kick out of each other, which I get a kick of the fact out of the fact they got a kick out of each other.
Do you think is there something significant in the fact that John Wooden was a retired iconic coach for as long as he was an active iconic coach?
That's a great question because I think that what John Wooden did in the last 3.5 decades of his life is far more significant than what he did while he was coaching. And I think he was a much happier man, even though it included the most unhappy experience of his life, which was losing his wife, Nell, who was his absolute soulmate. You know, as he says, the only girl I ever went with, the only girl he ever slept with is what he meant. You know, high school sweetheart, she did everything for him, and she passed in 1984, and many people thought that he wouldn't make it. But he lived a long time. His former players, he repaired a lot of those relationships. As the saying goes, as we get older, our fathers get smarter somehow. I think they went through, a lot of his players went through that with Wooden, where they got out into life, and they really thought about the things that he had taught them and wanted to reach out to him. And he evolved as well. You know, he was very open-minded to those ill feelings, very apologetic, very contrite. You know, he had that sign in his office, Mitch, that said, "It's what you learn after you know it all that counts." And he really lived that. You know, his philosophy was you just get a little bit better every day. And if you stay open-minded and you stay humble, you get a little bit better every day. And when your philosophy is get a little bit better every day and you really live that philosophy and you live to be almost 100, by the end of the road, you're going to be pretty good.
Seth Davis, it's a terrific story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Great to be with you, Mitch. Thank you.
Seth Davis covers college basketball for Sports Illustrated and CBS Sports. He's the author of Wooden, A Coach's Life, a biography of former UCLA basketball coach John Wooden. He was in Milwaukee in April. Another break now, and then Illinois writer Jalee Johnson's otherworldly steampunk-era middle-grade fantasy novel. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Dystopian themes are common in fiction for young readers, and at first blush, it might seem like Piper, the heroine of Jalee Johnson's recent middle grade novel, inhabits a dystopian world. But while Piper's circumstances are tough, her time is actually the industrial age in a fantasy world called Solace. The novel is called The Mark of the Dragonfly, and it opens as Piper has discovered an injured girl in the meteor fields outside her small scrapper town. It chronicles Piper's journey to help the girl, Anna, figure out who she is and where she came from. Johnson's journey to Milwaukee was an easier one. She made the trip up from Illinois to speak at classes in Elm Grove and New Berlin last month, and she stopped by our studio as well. Nice to meet you. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written novels in the past for a particular line of novels. There's a Dungeons and Dragons line of books that you've written for. But this one is a story entirely of your own making. How did you approach this novel differently than your other work?
The biggest difference in writing The Mark of the Dragonfly was that I got to create my own world from scratch, which was an amazing experience because I got to decide. You know, it's a fantasy world. I got to decide what the magic was like. I got to decide the different species and creatures that inhabit it. I created a whole world guide for myself where I sketched a map and I had lists of the food and drink, the characters and species that appear in the world. So that was a whole lot of fun and very different from writing in an established world, which is what the Dungeons and Dragons line of books are.
Well, and being that it's a fantasy world, it's not even like taking an existing place like Milwaukee or Chicago and trying to make the characters work in it. You've set it in this world called Solace, which is Earth-like, but it is not Earth. How fleshed out did it have to be before you could set the characters in motion?
Well, I knew that I wanted a world that had echoes of Earth, had echoes of our own world. And I liked exploring the idea of Solace being a world where the boundary between other worlds was thin, where on certain nights these violent meteor storms would bring down these objects from other worlds, not just from our own world, objects we might recognize, but things that we wouldn't have any idea what they were, forgotten bits of technology, art, and literature. And I like the idea of putting them into this new world and wondering what the people there would think of these objects. How would they use them? How would they fix them up and make them their own?
Is that part of the enjoyment for you, is not only introducing your readers to these characters and hoping they get to know the people that inhabit these stories, but also they're discovering the world as they're reading along?
Absolutely. One of my favorite things growing up as a reader was reading fantasy novels, but any novel where the setting would sweep me away to a different place where I could see, you know, and touch and taste the world and really inhabit it. As a kid, I loved and was amazed at how authors could do that, could make me feel these emotions and feel the world. And I really wanted to develop that ability to do that for other readers.
As I was getting ready for this, I was trying to figure out the significance to your setting. And there's this subgenre of fantasy that I guess I wasn't really familiar with beforehand called steampunk. And yes. I wonder, that it, obviously, if this is not, strictly speaking, a steampunk novel, it certainly has echoes of it. And I wonder how much that genre influences what you do.
It did influence it to a great degree, actually. I've been a fan of steampunk. And not just the idea of steam technology. I mean, obviously, there's the train, the steam engine that is a centerpiece of the book. But the idea of using these different technologies, I always say that the book is a combination of an industrial revolution and an age of exploration, because you have these two competing governments, one that wants to develop technology, airship technology, steam ocean steamers to explore unknown realms, and the other country who wants to develop weapons and take over, and the clash between these two governments and how it creates a class system and how the people are caught in the middle in this struggle and how they suffer. And I think that's a big component in steampunk as well, that idea of the common people, you know, struggling against these powers that are developing these technologies.
But it is not, strictly speaking, dystopian. Mm-hmm. This is not as bad as that, I guess.
Right. I wouldn't call it dystopia. When I think of dystopian, I think of something that the entire world going downhill in the most extreme of ways. I mean, there are definitely pockets in my world where circumstances are terrible and there's desperation, but there's also cities that are thriving and where people are doing well, and there's definitely hope in the world. It's not a completely bleak place to be.
it's a pivotal age is what you've created.
Yes, it's the two competing governments, and the world is kind of at a turning point. It's at a crossroads where it could go very bad or they could pull themselves out of it.
There are clues to the era in which it's taking place. I mean, your hero, Piper, is a scrapper. She lives in this village made up of people who collect debris that comes in on these meteor strikes. And there's a reference to a book that's found that looks suspiciously like The Wizard of Oz.
Yes. When I was playing with the idea of a time period, I was shooting for sort of a more, if you were to put it in Earth terms, it would be like a Victorian age. It would be the sort of the steampunk genre. But I took a few liberties here and there with the technology. I was picturing mid to late 1800s. I mean, obviously, I didn't want the technology to be too advanced. I didn't want the scrappers pulling out, you know, iPads from the from the meteor fields. So the technology is kind of more in Victorian times.
Well, let's talk about Piper. She is around the age of your audience, early teens, I guess. But she's a pretty self-sufficient girl for her age.
Yes, she is. She's had to grow up quickly, not only living in the scrap towns, but she's lost her father at the beginning of the novel, who's passed away working in a factory. And so she's really had to look out for herself and to try to survive. So that has definitely aged her beyond her years.
And the one thing that she is really, really good at that we learned fairly early on is she really has a way with machines.
Yes, she is. She's a talented machinist. In fact, she's the most talented machinist in her scrap town. The people of her village will bring her machines that have broken down, that they've scavenged from the meteor fields, and they will have her fix them. She's so talented that she has a great reputation. And also, some people can't believe that she's so talented that that she could make these machines work. They say that some machines will only work for her.
Well, and this is a good transition to the event that sets the story in motion. She's discovered an injured girl. What do we know about Anna as we meet her?
Anna is a very mysterious girl. In fact, when Piper first finds her, she thinks she's dead, that she's been killed in this meteor storm. But when she regains consciousness, she's completely disoriented. She doesn't know. She's lost her memory. She doesn't know who she is, where she comes from. And she gradually remembers her name. And the only distinctive feature about her is that she is marked. There's a mysterious tattoo on her arm of a dragonfly, which is an indication to Piper. She recognizes the symbol. It means that this girl is a very important person, that she's protected by the king of the dragonfly territories.
The two of them, Piper and Anna, find their way onto a train, the 401, in an effort to get to the capital of the dragonfly territories, Noveen, to presumably send Anna back to her home.
Yes. Piper believes that if she can help Anna get back to her home, regain her memory, she wants to help Anna, but she also sees an opportunity to maybe collect a reward for herself for getting Anna home, because she thinks if she's protected by the king that she has to come from a wealthy family. And if Piper can get a reward for bringing her home, then maybe she can pull herself out of the scrap towns and out of poverty and start a new life for herself.
But it does not take too long of being with Anna for her to be torn. Piper realizes that there's really more at stake to this mission she finds herself on than just the idea of getting a reward at the end of it.
Yes, she does. She determines very early on that not only is Anna an important person, but she's also a target. She's a target of some very, very nasty people who want her for their own reasons. She doesn't know what those are, but early on she develops a protective instinct towards Anna, and the two of them become friends. That was one of the things that I loved exploring with these two characters, is they are so very different and they have different motivations, but it doesn't take long for them to find common ground and for them to come together and want to help each other and save each other.
It's a real touching development that as their relationship develops. It really I thought that was one of the parts that was the most delightful about this.
Well, thank you. I loved writing, not only writing the banter back and forth between them, because they can fight like sisters and they have that relationship. But yes, just to see the development and the bond that grows stronger between them as the story goes along. It was one of my favorite parts of the writing.
And then the bond is affected as well because they face danger on this train. It's not just they don't get on the train and instantly find themselves in Noveen. They're under the protection of a fairly young boy named G, who also turns out not to be exactly what he seems.
G is a very mysterious presence. He's the protector and the guardian of the 401 train. He's part of its crew. He's been a part of the train crew for most of his life. It's his home. And at first, when Piper and Anna come on board, he sees them as a threat to the safety of his home. And so he wants to get rid of them as soon as possible. But again, as the story moves along and he sees what danger they're in and what risk, he also develops a protective instinct towards the two girls and wants to help them.
Well, so we don't want to give away too much in this book, but there is a certain amount of self-discovery that's at the heart of it, it seems.
Yes, it's very much discovering your identity, discovering what strengths you have, what powers you have to affect change in the world and to protect the people that you care about. And also coming to terms with the scary parts of who you are and accepting yourself. Yeah, I hope that came through in the book because I really wanted that to be a part of the story in addition to the friendship and the working together.
Well, so as I was reading some of the things that you have written and getting ready for this interview, I think it was a blog post or maybe it was just part of your FAQ, the idea that you have created this world, but you don't have, strictly speaking, any plans for a sequel to this story, which after reading the end, you could almost imagine somebody holding up a sign that says, to be continued.
I've heard conflicting reports there. I've heard a lot of people say they love it as a standalone, and I've heard other people say that, yes, we want a sequel now. Start writing, please. I think the doorway is open for a sequel, but the book I'm working on right now it's actually a companion novel to this one. It's set in the same world, takes place a short time after the events of the story, but it does follow different characters, but it develops the world more and you'll get more information about the background of this world of Solace. But I would never say the door is shut for a sequel, if that makes you feel better.
Well, and frankly, I think it works fine as a standalone novel also. But, you know, you get to the end of the ride, you almost want to know what happens to these guys next.
You want to know where the train stops next.
Exactly. What is it that appeals to you about the middle grade audience?
I like their sense of wonder. I have heard my writing described as kind of quirky, maybe a little bit romantic, maybe kind of odd. And kids, for whatever reason, seem to respond to that. They like the quirky characters. They like the detailed fantasy worlds. They like to get lost in them. They like to have enough detail that their imaginations can fill in the rest. And it seems like we mesh well together as reader and author. So I like that.
Well, and I wondered if the middle grade audience is especially open to a fantasy world that perhaps older readers, it might just take a little bit more getting them into this place that they don't know.
Right. It seems like kids are much more apt to join you on the journey. You know, they know that you'll explain enough about the world to, you know, have them centered, have them grounded, and then they're willing to and they're eager to see the fantastical creatures that inhabit it or the way it's different from our own world. They're much more eager to jump on board with you.
As you meet with students, so you're doing that in the Milwaukee area as we're having this conversation, what are the kinds of questions that they're asking about this?
I get a lot of questions about writing. The students are I tell them that I write that I used to write short stories in notebooks, that I used to scribble in journals, and I ask them, have you ever done the same thing? And I get all kinds of hands. They are young writers. They want to know about how to get published. They want to know how to deal with writer's block. All of they want to know what it takes to make it as a writer, which I love getting those questions. And I always tell them that I love games and gaming, and I get a lot of gaming questions as well from all of them. So it's been a lot of fun.
Well, Jillie Johnson, the book is terrific. Thank you so much for spending some time and sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Jillie Johnson's new middle grade novel is called The Mark of the Dragonfly. She was in the Milwaukee area recently to talk to students at schools in Elm Grove and New Berlin, and she joined us then. Our interview first aired in May. An essayist's view of life on the playground when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Do you remember those lazy, unstructured days of summer when all you had stretching in front of you was time at the pool or the playground? Often now, kids have lots of planned activities as they get older through the summer months. But when you're the parent of a toddler, long afternoons at the playground are still a draw. That's where Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce has watched her toddler evolve.
It is officially playground weather here in the Brew City. And when you're 2.5 years old, a jungle gym has its own magnetic pull, reeling you into the adventures of climbing and sliding and crawling and swinging. Wood chips and rubber make up your new landscape as you bound from one new planet to the next. Donning an Elmo t-shirt, you are fearless, a commander of your own destiny. You might as well have a cape. We parents of super toddlers push the strollers and wagons and tricycles to the playground and watch our babies transform into superheroes. Our hearts beam and our stomachs knot as our larger-than-life 2-year-olds climb to the top of the tower and teeter somewhere between euphoric accomplishment and a broken femur. A cautious child myself, I so admire my son's willingness to push the limits of his 3-foot frame. I push him, too, to try, to practice, remembering second grade recess when I just couldn't quite get up to that high bar. Now I shadow and spot my son as he tests his limits. He's the superhero. I'm the protector. It is my job to encourage him and keep him safe. It is my job to be the safe place to fall. One bright afternoon, I assume my role as coach and cheer my little guy on as he eyes the big kid ladder. Let's give it a shot, I encourage, as he nudges the bottom rung with his blue croc sandal. Glancing back at me, he gives a small smile and hops forward, grabbing the first rung. After a few swift maneuvers, he's made it nearly halfway up on his own, my hands at his sides to catch any slip. The ladder starts to curve, forcing him to climb parallel to the ground and forcing me to adjust my hands underneath his arms. He hesitates, and I say, "It's okay, Mama's got you." His weight lurches forward just enough so my left hand can't get a solid grip. His foot slips, and he falls forward, hard, on the bar before sliding between two others and smacking his head on the way down. I swoop him up immediately as he shrieks and cries and rush him under the shade of an oak tree. I can tell he's fine, just shaken and feeling the smart of his blows. As I hold his head to my shoulder and shush, it's okay, I'm so sorry. All I can think of is the promise I made that was broken. Mama's got you. How much of this does he understand? How much does one broken moment affect his understanding of the world, of trust, of me? Just as I'm picturing him as a 40-year-old recluse with a panic disorder, I feel a wriggling in my arms and he's hobbling off to the sandbox because the really, really big shovel is available. We dig in the sand and build as if nothing had happened, and I eye him, waiting for some kind of 2-year-old meltdown that says in its own way, "Mommy, how could you?" None comes. After he's had his fill of sand, he hops out of the box. "Mama, come over." He makes his way back to the curved ladder. Without asking, without a word, he takes the first rung. I stand by his side just like before, but this time with my hands lightly around his small waist. As the ladder curves, he hesitates, then stretches forward, nearly lying on the rungs until he can just make it to the top. He slides forward onto the tower's platform, then pops up immediately and swings around. "I did it, Mama," he cries, beaming down at me. His own superhero.
Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce is a Listen to Your Mother essayist and 2014 Milwaukee cast member. She writes, strangles, and raises that super toddler with her husband in Whitefish Bay. That's Monday's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.